start off as usual with checking your body, make sure that you're nice and relaxed again. You're feeling at ease, you have no tensions, you're feeling nice and easy. Just as normal, just go through your body stage by stage and make sure everything is nice and easy. It's so important to always make sure you enjoy the meditation. So always go back to the body. If there's any kind of tension or any problem anywhere, just move, take a few deep breaths and allow the tension to dissipate. And then you will find the meditation so much more delightful, so much more beautiful. And the chance of actually getting some peace and happiness increases dramatically. You are really relaxing here is not so much the body. Of course, the body is important, but what you really are relaxing is actually the mind. Because it's the tense mind, or the mind which is active, doing things, that is what causes tension in the body in the first place. So by relaxing the body, you're actually starting the calming of the mind itself. So for that reason, every time you feel any tension, anything in the body which doesn't feel quite right, go back and relax that again and again and again. And you will find that that is enough to also have a good effect on the mind. And the mind will also become more peaceful. purpose of this meditation is just to learn how to enjoy the peace. First of all, to see the peace that is there, and to see how beautiful and delightful that peace actually is. It is not to create the peace, it's not to make the peace, it's not to do anything at all, but just to see the peace and enjoy that much. If you can do that, then you've gone a long way in your meditation practice. just try to savor the beauty of the peace. Just feel how nice it is compared to the ordinary life of talking or busyness. How wonderful it is to do nothing at all, just feeling peaceful, nothing happening in your mind. And the more you feel that sense of peace, the more the mind will incline towards it, because it's a beautiful sensation. Just allow it slowly, stage by stage, to just grow inside of you. Feel more and more peaceful, more and more at ease, more and more relaxed. If you find yourself being carried away by a thought, for example, don't use any force to bring the mind back into the present moment. Just gently lead the mind into the present again, and just see the beauty of the peace. And by seeing the beauty of the peace, the mind will naturally incline back to the present moment. No force, just seeing the beauty of what is already there. now I'd like you to pick one of the four directions, say the eastern direction, and it doesn't matter if you know where east is or not, just choose one direction. And in that eastern direction, imagine all the people out there, people very often good-hearted, kind people. People are striving in their lives to find happiness, to find meaning, to find purpose. People who want to be happy, to want to be at peace, and yet often finding much more suffering than they had ever bargained for in their life. And all these people out there who are a prey to suffering, a prey to problems, it's all the same for everybody. We all have more suffering than we want. We all have these things that we just cannot control. All these good-hearted people out there in the eastern direction, may they all be well. All the animals who also are a prey to suffering, may they also be well and happy. And then move your attention to the northern direction. So think about the northern direction. Again, all the people out there, including the nuns in Dhammasara Monastery, and all those people out there, again, who want suffering in their lives, who want happiness in their lives, don't know where to find it. May all those people, may they be happy, may they be free of suffering. move your attention to the western direction. And you don't need to say very much in this meditation. You don't need to say anything again and again. The most important thing is to establish the perception inside of you of people who are worthy of your compassion, worthy of your kindness. So look to the western direction. And again, remind yourself that there are millions and millions of people out there who are kind-hearted, who are good, and yet who suffer much more than they want in their life. And they have no choice. That suffering that they have is part and parcel of life. They can't get away from it. And they're all worthy of your compassion for that reason. So may all those people out there, all those animals, again, who are a prey to suffering, may they all find happiness and freedom and release. Then bring your attention to the southern direction. And again, all those people out there, faceless people, people you have never met before, people who are striving to do what is good in life and to avoid all the bad things, people who know that goodness is the path to happiness, but often they have a hard time, often it's difficult. May they all be happy. May they find the happiness that they truly are searching for. And lastly, bring your attention back into this hall. And just remind yourself for a second that all these people around you here today, these are good, kind, well-meaning people. Anybody who comes on a meditation retreat is somebody who has some special willingness to do something good in this world. So regardless of all the small, petty little things that sometimes irritate us, remember the foundational goodness and kindness that is there in all the people around you. And may you all be happy. May you all be well. May you find that peace that you are searching for in life. Okay, so that's the end of the meditation. Please come out and sit comfortably. Okay, so I hope you are enjoying your retreat. And if you're not enjoying it, maybe you need to change something to look at things a little bit differently. So I'm going to talk about those things that make a meditation retreat enjoyable and nice, so that you can make sure you can use these 2 days you have here to the maximum benefit. And of course, one of the first things to always remember that if your meditation isn't going so well, one of the most important things for long-term success in meditation is how your actions are in daily, ordinary life. And you will find that one of the things that you can contemplate during this retreat is the effect that your ordinary actions do have on your meditation practice. And if you look at that very carefully, you will see that in general, if you live an ethical life, if you are a kind person, and this is also the kindness of the heart, if you have that kindness of the heart, where you're willing to help other people, where you're willing to say something nice at the right time, you're willing to do something good, you have a sense of generosity inside of you, a sense of gentleness and softness and kindness to other beings. Once you develop that ethical standard, gradually, over time, over the months, over the years, you will see that you become a much more peaceful person also in your meditation practice. And it's not just in meditation, you also become more peaceful in daily life. And of course, that is very valuable, because that peace is a sense of ease, a sense of relaxedness, a sense of feeling good about yourself. And that is it's the sort of thing that everybody is seeking for. And that becomes a very powerful thing. And, of course, it will have an effect in your meditation practice. Because meditation is about just that, about feeling at ease and relaxed. And the deeper your meditation goes, the more at ease and the more relaxed you will feel. So notice that on this retreat. Look at that, how the ethical conduct you have been practicing maybe over time, see how it actually works. See how it affects your meditation practice. See how it affects your general state of mind. And then when you do that, you get this beautiful synergy almost between your ethics and your meditation practice. You want to go back and you want to be a kinder person. And then when you're a kinder person, you know that this is leading to meditation. So you have more of a motivation to actually practice that kindness. And these things go beautifully together. And that is the long-term thing. And use a retreat like this, because now when you get away from your ordinary life, you get a bit more perspective than you normally have. And that perspective gives you the ability to see things that you normally are not able to see. And you can see the connection between ethics and meditation in particular. A beautiful saying of the Buddha, he said that it is samadhi. In other words, samadhi is like meditation practice, deep meditation. Samadhi that is imbued and supported by ethics. That is the samadhi that is really powerful and really takes you somewhere. Samadhi without ethics is never going to lead very far. Samadhi with ethics is going to be a very powerful thing. It's going to take you a long way on your spiritual journey, or just your journey of, being a Buddhist or whatever you want to call it. So this is the first thing. But the second thing on a retreat like this, because now that you're here, of course you can try to be kind and nice when you're here. Of course, that's a very good thing to do. But now, one of the most important things now is to make sure that you strive and you practice in the right way. And to give you some idea what the right way of practice is and what the wrong way of practice is, and imagine the kind of mindfulness and concentration that you have, for example, at work. You are doing something at work, maybe something you don't like all that much. You have to read an essay, or you have to write something, a report or something like that. But it's not something you really enjoy doing. So what do you do if you don't enjoy something? What you do is that you have to force your mindfulness. You have to force your mind onto the thing because you don't enjoy it. I'm sure you all know what I mean. I'm sure you all can relate to that. And that's why I use this simile. Whenever you don't want to do something, but you have to do it, you have to use a measure of force normally to be able to do that. And how do you feel if you have a whole day where you have to use force to be able to do something? You feel exhausted at the end of the day. You feel tired. You come back home and you just want to lie down and you want to have a good night's sleep because you are tired from all that power in the mind, all that effort used in the mind to be able to stick with the task that you have. And that is what in meditation is called wrong concentration. This is the ordinary concentration in life where we use force, we use power to be able to stick with the object that is in front of us. And it always leads to tiredness of the mind. It is the mind wanting to move away to do something else, not to be in the present moment, because the present moment is not pleasant. Because not pleasant, the mind doesn't want to be there, you have to use more force again. So there's two ways of dealing with that. The first way is to make that particular object that you have to deal with, to make it beautiful, to create something nice out of that object. So if you are at work and you don't like the report that you have to read or whatever, you have to change your perception. How can I see this as something valuable? How can I see this as something beautiful? How can I make this maybe to think about it, that this is something I do to further and to help somebody somewhere? And once you're able to change your perception and see that you're doing something valuable, something useful, then suddenly what appeared before as an unpleasant task can become something which is a pleasant task. And the same thing in meditation practice. To understand that, well, right now, right here, right now, what I'm doing, you know maybe from past experience in meditation, that this can lead to something beautiful and nice. And remind yourself of that. This is an important part of the spiritual practice. This is the time to be at peace. Time to enjoy this and just relax and sit back. So the concentration that we want to achieve in meditation practice is not the type where you use force. It is a natural concentration or a natural focus that arises all by itself. And that's why when I sit here, I say just relax. Allow things to be. Don't do anything. whatever happens is okay. Whatever is going on, accept it exactly as it is, whether it's thinking or tiredness or noises outside or blinking in the eyes, whatever it is. Just accept everything as it is. Don't try to be peaceful. Don't try anything at all. And the less you try, the more peaceful you start to become. And the right time to start watching the breath, or to do metta practice, or to do whatever meditation practice you do, is to do it when it arises all by itself. You will find that when you start to become peaceful, suddenly the breath comes into the mind for no apparent reason. The reason, of course, is that you are becoming more mindful. You are coming into the present moment. And in the present moment, one of the most obvious objects in that moment is precisely the breath. The breath is quite a prominent object in the present moment. So the mind will eventually naturally come to the breath. And when it comes naturally to the breath, you just observe it as it is. And then it will disappear again, because that's the nature of the breath. It disappears because your mindfulness still isn't strong enough. And that's okay. You allow it to disappear. And then after a while again, it will appear again, and you put your focus on it. And this is the best way to achieve that samadhi, achieve that natural concentration and mindfulness. Well, there's no force, there's no power, there's just a natural focus on the object. And that is right meditation. When you get that, that's when you really are going really well. Things are going in the right direction. So to be able to do this, I will also recommend you another practice that the Buddha taught a lot, and that is, of course, the metta practice, the loving kindness. And a retreat like this is a good opportunity to test that out a little bit. And one of the most important things to be able to make metta practice work is that you actually have an object in your mind that you feel is worthy of your metta. You have to see something that you feel is worthy of your good intentions. Once you feel that this object is worthy of your good intentions, then it's quite easy to wish that being, to wish that group of people, may you be well, may you be happy. If you don't really have the sense that they're worthy of your kindness, it is very difficult to give rise to this intention. So one of the things to do that, and this has to do with a training in Buddhism you might call the training in perception, to learn how to perceive things in a new way, in an altered way. And this is very fundamental in Buddhism. The Buddha went so far as to say that this understanding perception properly, which perceptions to cultivate, which not to cultivate, this is the whole of the Buddhist path. And this is the difference between somebody who makes progress on the path and somebody who does not. So if you want to make progress, you have to learn how to choose the right perceptions, how to choose to look at the world in the right way. And only then are you going to be able to give rise to things like metta, for example. So today, if you try the metta practice, you can use this, for example, when you do walking meditation. And all you need to do sometimes is to remind yourself of the good qualities in a particular person or a particular group of people. I often sometimes do this in the monastery. I go back and forth my walking path and I think, why? How wonderful it is that I'm living in a place where there are roughly 30 other people dedicated to kindness, to compassion, to peace, to being good, to doing something good in this world. Wow, that is a wonderful thing. Now, of course, they're not perfect. Of course, they're going to make mistakes from time to time. But what do those mistakes matter compared to that willingness to take on a large number of precepts, willingness to be kind, willingness to do good things, having an intention to be a good person in this world? That is what really matters. And when you look at that foundation in these people, and when you see that, then you can lay aside, put away all those petty little things that happen in daily life, where we get irritated by small little things that really are completely irrelevant. And we see the big picture, and that gives rise to a sense of kindness towards these people, because we see their good qualities. And of course, that's part one, seeing the good qualities in people. And then the other part is to see that regardless of how good people are, they also have suffering in their lives. And it's not their choice. This, I think, is why one of the very important insights of Buddhism, when you confuse the idea of suffering with the idea of non-self is the idea that people suffer regardless. It's not something they choose. It must happen in life that you have suffering here. And this is very important to understand, because when you do that, you don't blame other people for their own suffering here. You don't blame yourself for your suffering here. You realize this is something that is inescapable, nothing you can really do anything about. And when you see a good person, somebody who's kind, somebody who wants to do something nice, and yet they have suffering in their lives, when you build up that perception inside of you by doing it again and again and again, eventually there comes the point when you sit down and you say, may you be happy, may you be well, and you mean it, it comes from your heart. And when it comes from your heart, it becomes powerful, and it gives rise to a beautiful feeling inside of you. And that feeling is a sense of metta and compassion. So try this. This is very important. And it needs a lot of preparation. It needs this idea of changing your perception about the people around you, the world around you. And by gradually changing the perceptions, changing the way you look at things, gradually you develop something very beautiful and very wholesome. And you find that this becomes a powerful support in your general meditation practice, whether it's anapanasati, the breath meditation, or whether it's just your virtue and kindness in daily life. All of these things move together in a wonderful way, and it all kind of blossoms and becomes something very powerful in your life. And of course, on a retreat like this, when you are close together, it's particularly important to have that sense of metta for the people around you. It's easy. It's always easy when we live close together to get a little bit irritated or upset by things which really are irrelevant. But that's just nature. That's just the way things are. That's just the way things are. And to try to avoid that, have that sense of metta for the people around you. So these are some of the very simple techniques of meditation practice. See if you can try to use those here on these 2 days you have. You only got 2 days, remember. Don't waste it. Bring in also your family back home. One of the great things about being on retreat is that you get a bit of distance from your family, and suddenly you can see them in a new way, in a new light. You can see them from a distance. You can think, yeah, actually, they're not such bad people. In daily life, it's very easy to get, the closer we are to somebody, the easier it is to get irritated by them. Now you have a chance to get some distance. Think about them. Yeah, they have lots of good qualities. They keep the 5 precepts, whatever. They are kind and generous. What do all these minor little things really matter? And bring your family into it, because having a good family life is also a very powerful foundation for a good spiritual life. They go together. Okay. Okay, I think that's probably enough, just to give you a little bit of input on meditation practice. There's a lot of questions here as well, so I think I'll move on to those next, and we'll see, take it from there. Does anybody have any other questions they want to ask while I'm at it? Does anybody have anything they want to say? No? Everybody happy? Okay, great. Okay, so the first thing, somebody put a note here saying, please remind people to keep silent in the cottages. Okay. This is one of the ways of looking at this, which I have taught here in the past, is that sometimes people feel that silence is like oppressive. I have to be silent, whatever. If you look at it that way, then silence becomes something very negative on the meditation retreat. So don't look at it as something oppressive. Another way of looking at silence is to think of it as a gift that you give to the people around you. Think, okay, there are good meditators on this retreat. There are people who are getting nice states of samadhi. If I'm silent and quiet, I'm helping them and supporting them in their practice. So think of it as a gift of generosity that you're giving to the people around you. And then instead of making the silence something oppressive, you make it into something that you give to others. And it becomes part and parcel of your practice, of your path for your own peace and your own happiness. Just a small reminder there. Okay, so let's see what people are asking about here. Okay. Are the enlightened ones, enlightened person, mindful and conscious 100% of the time, other than sleeping? Yeah. Okay. The answer to that is that I think basically the answer is yes. And you find that in the suttas, it says that somebody who is, I actually prefer the word awakening rather than enlightenment, because awakening has this idea that we are waking up to some truth, that we are now deluded, we are blinded by something. And suddenly one day, it's like we wake up and we see the big picture. To me, that is a very beautiful idea. It's a bit like when you practice the spiritual life and you start to see things differently, more clearly than you did before. You can see a gradual awakening happening as you become more peaceful, as you become more kinder. You feel better about yourself. Things become more clear. Everything is more sharp. You understand what you're doing. You understand how to behave correctly. This is a gradual awakening. In this sense, you're awakening gradually until you sort of hit the big jackpot and you really awakened. So yes, they are mindful all the time, but remember that mindfulness is a quality that is not, has many different qualities to it, if you like. Mindfulness can be sharp, very, very sharp, or it can be less sharp. And even for somebody who is fully awakened, the sharpness of the mindfulness will actually vary during the day, depending on what they do. If they meditate very deeply, when they come out, the mindfulness will be very, very sharp. If they are very active and they have a lot of sensory impingement, then even an enlightened person will have, the mindfulness will be there, but it won't be as sharp as it otherwise would be. So there's a degree of sharpness there. But yes, they will be enlightened. They will be mindful all the time, which also means that they are able to have perfect virtue. Because perfect virtue depends on you being aware of what you're doing at all times, so you can sort of hold your mind in check. It also depends, of course, on the defilements that you have. Is the above what a monk or person should strive for? In a sense, yes, it's good. Of course, it's good to be mindful. It's good to strive for mindfulness to some extent. But what is even more important than striving for mindfulness? You can see the danger there. When you say striving for mindfulness, it's like saying, okay, I'm going to sort of grit my teeth and, you know, grasp the moment and force myself to be mindful. And that's what you have to be careful about. If you strive too much to be mindful, if you put too much force into the mindfulness, it is often counterproductive because it leads to tension, it leads to a lack of ease, it leads to something which doesn't really work properly. So what is more important than striving to be mindful is to strive for the causes of mindfulness. What makes me mindful naturally? That is much more important than striving for mindfulness itself. So what is it that makes you mindful naturally? One thing is to just sit down and relax in your meditation practice and allow the mindfulness to happen. Another one, in the long run, is very important, as I mentioned before, is just being a kind and good person. Kindness and goodness leads to mindfulness in the long run because you feel good about yourself. When you feel good about yourself, you want to be in the present moment. When you are in the present moment, you are mindful. Another one is the metta meditation, when you have a sense of metta and kindness to people around you. Again, you feel good about yourself. So it's natural that you want to be in the present moment. Not being mindful is almost like an escape, right? You're thinking about the past, thinking about the future, you're dreaming, you have sloth and torpor, you have restlessness. It's like an escape. If the present moment is pleasant, you want to be here now. So focus on these causes. And when you focus on the causes, then mindfulness will happen by itself. This is really the trick. Too much striving to be mindful. Of course, a little bit of striving is okay, because sometimes we have to hold back from doing wrong things or whatever. But be careful about this over-striving that sometimes happens when people practice mindfulness. I remember some years ago I went to Singapore and I was living in the flat that this man owned, and he came one day to visit me. And he said to me, you know, I've given up on meditation because I went to this retreat once. He was a Malaysian man. I went to this retreat and I became so uptight and so tense. I never, ever want to do meditation practice again. And of course, if that happens, then it's very, very counterproductive. That it was an extreme case. But even if you get a little bit tense and tight in meditation, it has a negative consequence. Are we just striving to be mindful and conscious as much as we can to avoid fear, anguish, resistance, etc.? Well, to avoid fear, anguish, and resistance, I would say practice. Metta practice is the most powerful antidote to negative states of mind in general, including fear. When you have metta, it's almost the opposite of fear when you have metta. You have a lot of trust when you have metta, usually wise trust. You don't have stupid trust, but you have a wise sense of trust if you use it in a skillful way. So use the metta practice, and then that metta will help you to have mindfulness as well. What's the middle way here? Okay, the middle way is the path to awakening. That's what the middle way is. Why is it called the middle way? The reason it's called the middle way is that at the time of the Buddha in India, 2,500 years ago, most people thought that the path to awakening was by ascetic practices, by torturing the body, by lying on beds of nails. You've seen these cartoons. They're actually true. It's very interesting. You hear about the beds of nails, then you read the suttas, and it says in the word of the Buddha, you know, people were actually doing these things even 2,500 years ago. It's quite fascinating. And so people did these things. And I think it seems to be one of the things in the human psyche that we seem to think that pain somehow is good practice. If we do something painful, it will lead to spiritual progress. Seems to be very deeply embedded in us. And it's true if you look across many religious traditions, whether it was in India, in the Hinduism, whether it is in the Christian tradition, whether you go to a Buddhist retreat these days and people sit through pain and they have all kinds of tensions and problems. It seems to be somehow we think that if we do something which is painful and unpleasant, it will be something which is good for us. But actually, the Buddha said it isn't like that. Pain is not in itself a good thing. Sometimes a little bit of pain is fine, as long as it leads in the right direction. But generally speaking, we shouldn't seek for pain for its own, as if it has some kind of purifying effect of its own. It doesn't. And this was one of the first breakthroughs that the Buddha had in his understanding of meditation and the spiritual path, that pain is actually to be avoided. And before that, he also had the understanding earlier on that the pleasures of the five senses is another thing that needs to be avoided. Because the pleasure of the five senses also leads you outside of yourself. If you get pleasure through the things that you see, through the things you taste, through the things you touch, through the five senses, it means that your mind is going out to the senses. If it goes out of you, it's the opposite of staying still inside. And this is why we need to, on a retreat like this, it's great to avoid too much of the five sense pleasures. That's why we keep the eight precepts, for example. The eight precepts are there to restrain ourselves, to hold yourselves back. There's a very interesting case in the suttas, and Buddha speaks to, I think it's Lady Visakha, who was one of his main women lay supporters in those days. She's very famous in the suttas. And he says to this Lady Visakha that is the right way and the wrong way to practice the eight precepts. The eight precepts would normally be practiced when lay people came to the monastery in those days, and they would come clad in white. They would go to the monastery, they would have one meal a day, and they would practice meditation and listen to the Dhamma for the rest of the day. And the Buddha said to Lady Visakha, there's three different types of way of practicing this Upasata. And the first one was like, he was talking about some other religions in those days where they, you know, slaughter beings and all these kind of things. And he said that is definitely the wrong way of practicing the Upasata. But another way of practicing the Upasata, which is also wrong, is when you come to the monastery, you sit down and then you think about all the things you're going to be doing tomorrow. Or tomorrow I'm going to be cooking this, I'm going to be making that, I'm going to be going to the movies, I'm going to sort of listen to this music. And all these things that you think about when that you're going to do tomorrow, as if, you know, I have to go through this day today, I have to keep these eight precepts today, but at least I'm going to think about all the nice things I'm going to do tomorrow. And the Buddha says to Lady Visakha, if you practice the Upasata like that, it doesn't have much benefit. It doesn't have much, there's nothing really in it for you if you do it that way. Then he says the right way of practicing the Upasata is when you take the eight precepts, is then to use the day and practice metta meditation. This is the specific thing he said to her. You sit down and you do just like we did before. You spread out your goodwill, your good intentions to the beings in all the different directions. That is, he said, that kind of apostata, that kind of practice, he said, has great benefit and great results for you in the future. So that is the way. And what is happening here, of course, is that the person who sits there thinking about all the pleasures they're going to indulge in tomorrow, even though they have taken on the 8 precepts, they haven't really renounced those sensual pleasures yet. They have only renounced them in a very superficial way by not contacting them directly, but they're still very much present in the mind. And for that, the mind goes out to these things. So the purpose then of the 8 precepts is not just to, you know, have some kind of suffering whereby you are not doing these things. It's actually to get away from those sensual pleasures altogether, both externally but also internally inside of yourself, when you don't actually think about these things. And then the mind can settle inside of you in a beautiful way. And of course, the external thing, the other side of the going the wrong way, that which is not the middle way here, where you torture the body. When you torture the body, again, there is an interest in the body there, because the mind is interested in the pain, because the pain is something unpleasant. So the mind will tend to go to that thing which is unpleasant, try maybe to figure out a way to get out of it. Pain is something which is inherently interesting for us. The mind always tends to go to the pain. Because we don't like it, we want to get rid of it, the mind goes there. So the problem then with the two extremes, which is not the middle way, they both tend to lead us outside of ourselves, to external things, to the 5 senses. And for that, we're not able to stay inside and just be peaceful with ourselves, watch the breath, do the metta practice, whatever. So that is really the middle way. And of course, the middle way is also explained as the Noble Eightfold Path. But the Noble Eightfold Path is really just a path of purifying ourselves. Those 8 factors can just be looked upon as purification. How to become more and more and more pure-hearted. Until you're so pure-hearted that when you sit down, your mind is clear, you can watch the breath with ease, everything is just wonderful. So it's a gradual move towards pureness, purity, purity, purity. And when the purity reaches a certain point, you can go into very deep meditation. And that is when you can actually see things in accordance with reality in the Buddhist way. And that, of course, is what ultimately, I guess, certainly in monastic life, many lay Buddhists as well are striving for, this ability to see things as they actually are. That's what I mean by awakening. You awaken to the way things actually are. You're not no longer in this kind of dream state. Happy with the middle way? Yeah? Okay, I heard that meditation is about letting go. Letting go of what? Okay, that's a very good question, because it may not be obvious. But as you probably heard now from the way I described the middle way, the main thing that we're trying to let go of is sensuality, the 5 senses, the thinking about, the eating, the what we're seeing, what we're hearing, all these kind of things. That is the most important thing. In Pali, the word for letting go, one of the words for letting go is nekama. Nekama literally is the opposite of desire. Desire here means desire in terms of the 5 senses. So we're moving away. Renunciation here means renouncing the 5 senses. So that's what we're trying to let go of. That's the first thing. And that includes, of course, the body. It includes all these other things as well. And that is no easy thing. It takes a long time. Sometimes people say, but how do I let go? How do we do this? And that's another very good question. Indeed, how do you let go? And the answer is, there's 2 reasons why people are able to let go. One reason is that you develop yourself, you develop a mind that is at ease and relaxed and independent. You have happiness inside of yourself. And the more happiness you source from inside of yourself, you find inside of yourself, the less you are dependent on external happiness, the easier it is to let go of the 5 senses. Why? Because they don't mean so much to you anymore. You already have a source inside of you of peace and happiness. So what does the external really matter? So this is what the path is about. It's building up something inside of you that is very powerful and very strong, so that the externals become less and less important as you move along. So that is the first aspect in being able to let go, is having a source of happiness inside of you. The second aspect of being able to let go is that you understand the suffering in the five senses. That which is suffering is easy to let go of. If you have a hot coal in your hand by accident, you let go of it very quickly because it's painful. It's very easy to understand you have to let go of the hot coals. The more you understand the suffering of the five senses, and of course that understanding comes also as your meditation matures. As your meditation matures, you can see that happiness actually is found elsewhere than the five senses. Gradually, and you come to see the five senses more clearly. Your meditation improves even more. You see the five senses even more clearly. Your meditation improves even more. And these things build on each other, stage by stage, gradually. So sometimes it's useful to actually think about the pain of the five senses. Yes, there is pleasure in the five senses, but there's also pain. And one thing always comes with the other. You cannot just have pleasure in the five senses. They always come together. Understanding that and having a refuge inside of yourself of happiness, those two things together move you away from the five senses, and it helps you to let go. So it's a gradual path. It's not going to happen overnight, but you will, if you keep doing this over a long period of time, after a while you think, gee, this is really working. Something is happening here. I often think of myself, what is really the reason that I keep being a monk? People think sometimes it's madness to become a Buddhist monk. But the reason really is that, you know, of course, even monastic life is never perfect. But the general thing is that there's a general movement towards greater peace and greater happiness. And when I look at the person I am today compared to who I was 17 years ago when I first entered monastic life, well, the changes are just the difference is so enormous that it's, for myself at least, I'm hardly recognizable. It doesn't mean I'm perfect now. It doesn't mean that I don't make mistakes or whatever. I still, do silly things and I still think the wrong things and all this kind of stuff, of course. But the general trend is in the right direction. And that gives you a very powerful impetus and to keep practicing and doing the right thing. And this is the same thing with letting go. Gradually, stage by stage, it happens. All right. How did the Buddha teach meditation? Okay, great. There's some really good questions here today. I'm really happy about this. And the Buddha, the main teaching of meditation in the suttas is what is called anapanasati, mindfulness of the breath. This is the thing you find again and again in the suttas, the Buddha teaching. And so that is his main meditation technique. It is not an easy meditation because you have to be basically mindful before you can watch the breath. So you have to be able to sit down, close your eyes, and basically have mostly a silent mind, silent and clear mind. That silent and clear mind, that is the mindful mind. And when you have that, then the breath meditation will happen. There are not that many people who can do breath meditation because it is a very difficult and profound practice. And that's why it is useful to do some of the other meditations the Buddha taught, such as metta practice, loving kindness, which is more active and which is more, you can more use yourself. You can do it while you're walking. You can do it while you're sitting. You can do it any time. And that is the other kind of big practice that the Buddha also taught. So these are probably the two meditation practices, particularly metta, which is very useful, I think, to do. And otherwise, remember that it is often good enough if all you do in daily life. I don't know how much you meditate in daily life. Some of you probably haven't got much time. But even if you can do just 10 minutes or 20 minutes in the morning or in the evening, that's enough just to be able to feel peaceful. There's one man I know, he uses meditation only to feel peaceful, nothing else, just to relax and feel at ease and feel peaceful. And that's good enough, because if you do that, it means that you have more clarity, you feel better about yourself, and that clarity leads you to act in a better way in the world. When we are really confused, restless, things are running around in our heads, it's very hard to know what is up and what is down, and what is right and what is wrong, and what is front and what is back. And you end up doing all kind of mad things. So just being able to be peaceful is already a very powerful thing. And if you do it in the evening, you will find that if you go to sleep with a peaceful mind, perhaps even with a little bit of metta, loving kindness, you sleep so much better. You sleep beautifully. Wake up in the morning, you have energy, you're ready to take on a new day. So you can see how these things build on each other. So those are, I think, probably the two main meditations that Buddha taught in the suttas. He taught other things as well. But these are important and foundational things. Okay, please clarify how useful faith in the Buddha and the Dhamma is in one who meditates for worldly well-being, such as health, and two, deeper practice, such as letting go and creating inner bliss. And the answer is that faith is very useful. I don't really like the word faith that much because I feel it has too many Christian connotations. And the word in Pali is saddha. And saddha means more like confidence. You have confidence in the teachings of the Buddha. You think that these lead in the right direction. You feel that this is something beautiful here, something wonderful, and you have a sense of confidence. The Christian idea of faith is more like, okay, there's something out there we don't know anything about, and we cannot know anything about, and I choose to place faith in this thing that we cannot know anything about. So that is the Christian idea of faith. And of course, that idea of faith is something that cannot really be challenged. Because you're saying, I'm placing my faith in something nobody can know anything about, you can't really challenge that. But the Buddhist idea of faith is something you can challenge, because you are, things like rebirth, for example, is something that you can actually investigate by scientific means if you want to. Meditation itself is something you can investigate by scientific means. Does it make people more peaceful, or does it not make people more peaceful? And these are things you can actually measure quite objectively. So Buddhism, in that sense, is more a matter of confidence. And then when you place a measure of confidence in these things, then of course it's going to help you in your practice. If you have confidence that meditation will work, you will do it much more naturally and much more easily. So it is very, very useful to create inner peace and bliss, that you have that confidence in the teachings. How do you get that confidence? Well, there are many things, but I personally, one of the great ways that I gain confidence in the teachings is just to read a little bit of the Buddha's discourses and then reflect on them. Reflect on this. And I think many people will quite automatically see that when you read this discourse, that there's something powerful and beautiful here, something very strong, something very wise. You can almost feel the wisdom coming out of the words as you read them. There's something very, very good here. And when you see that, you think, wow, this is there's something wonderful here. And that gives rise to confidence. And of course, and then you start practicing here. And you start to see that actually it does work. It has an effect that gives even more confidence. And this builds on each other. So it is very important. One of the teachings that the Buddha gave is a teaching on what is called the five indriyas, the five faculties. And faculty is like powers in the mind that empowers your spiritual practice. And these five faculties start with faith, the faculty of faith. The faculty of faith leads to the faculty of energy. When you have faith, you think there's something to be done here. When you think there's something to be done, energy arises to do that. That energy leads to mindfulness, because the energy is like inspiration. That inspiration leads to mindfulness, which then leads to meditation, samadhi, which leads to wisdom. These are the five spiritual faculties. And the first one is faith. That's the foundational thing here. You see, in the suttas, the Buddha explained how you should arrive at faith in a particular person, for example. In those days, the teachings were oral teachings. Monks and nuns would travel around. They would give teachings to people who wanted to hear. And the person that you should place faith in, the Buddha said, is when you meet somebody, you look at them and you see that they haven't got, cannot see any defilements in this person. The less defilements the person have, in other words, the less greed they have, the less anger and irritation they have, the less delusion they have, these are the three root defilements in Buddhism, the more faith you can place in that person. This is how you decide who to place faith in. You have to use your own eyes and ears, your own faculties, to decide who is worthy of faith in this world. And I think people often do not take enough responsibility for their own spiritual life. They have faith in people for all the wrong reasons. They have faith because somebody else says this is a wonderful monk or a wonderful nun. Maybe they are a wonderful monk. Maybe they are a wonderful nun. But don't take these things for given until you see it for yourself. Because people say all kinds of strange things. You're going to hear all kinds of weird stuff in this life. And unless you are careful, you're going to be led astray in a serious manner. So watch for yourself. In the end, you have to take responsibility for your own faith, your own confidence, and your own spiritual practice. And that is the right kind of confidence, the right kind of faith. So read a bit of the word of the Buddha. Listen to Dhamma talks from whatever monks and nuns you feel are inspiring. Look at the conduct of people. Is it good conduct? Is it bad conduct? And all this together pushes you, leads you in the right direction. Does faith lead to world, to well-being such as health? I think that probably it does to some extent, because when you have confidence in something, it's like you have something which gives meaning in your life. When you have something which gives meaning in your life, you feel a sense of satisfaction and happiness. A happy person tends to have better health than somebody who's not happy. This has been scientifically shown many, many times before. So I think faith, to some extent, yes, it can have a good effect on health. But don't try to have faith. Don't force the faith on. Just allow it to come naturally as you make progress on the path. Okay, in the world where everything needs to be completed by yesterday, how do we increase the value of being patient, i.e. taking longer to do things, in things that we do, including meditation practice? So how to be patient? Yes, I'm sure that there is a lot of pressure out there in the world to get everything done on time and to do things. And I remember a few years ago, in Nolamara, I gave a talk about how to make decisions in life. How do you make decisions in life? How do you decide what kind of job you're going to have, what kind of partnership or relationship you're going to have, what kind of religion you should choose in life? How do you make all these decisions in life? And the wonderful thing is that the Buddha gave a very clear advice on how to decide on almost anything. And he said that whatever leads to an improvement in your spiritual qualities, whatever makes you a kinder, more mindful, more meditative person, that is the right choice. Any choice that will lead you to becoming a more nasty, more narrow-minded, scatterbrained person, that is the wrong choice. So you can use this even for your professional life. If you have to decide between two jobs, and you know that one is going to stress you out like mad, but it's going to give you a really wonderful salary and lot of prestige. Well, what is really important in your life? What are you going to remember when you die? Is it a nice and peaceful mind? Or is it a prestige and the money of the job? We all know what the answer is. But in the moment, often that prestige and the money seems incredibly important. But actually, remember always the big picture. And a very great way of remembering the big picture is to remember your deathbed. When you die, what is going to be important? The prestige of your job, all the money you had, it all has to go. It's not going to go with you. The only thing that goes with you is your mind, is the peace you have, the kindness you have, the compassion in your heart. This is what you take with you. So always think big. Think big picture. Don't think small things. Most of the world thinks small picture, and that's why they make all kind of silly decisions in life. So the best thing, so remember these things when you make decisions about your career or whatever, that these things are important. What is really going to be helpful for you? I'm not saying that having a career is wrong, by no means. If some people thrive on pressure, some people think it's great, it makes them more mindful, or they are just natural for them, having a career is great. But remember the big picture, regardless of what you do. So, if there is a lot of pressure on you, and you value your patience, you value doing things slowly, then maybe you should think of changing your job. Or maybe you should just do it slowly anyway, and then your employer will have to deal with it one way or another. If you cave in to the pressure and you don't have enough patience and it really messes up your mind, then of course you're going to come back home and you're going to be not so nice to your wife or to your husband and your children or your parents or whatever it is. And then you're going to feel bad about yourself, and it gets into this vicious cycle, and it's going to drag you down in life. So be careful about these things. Try to structure your life in such a way that you don't get too stressed out, too high-strung and too kind of pushed by external circumstances. Try to, you know, not look at things the way other people look at it. Try to think of things in your own way. Be independent. Do things your own way. Do what works. Be wise about this. Don't allow the world to sort of push you around, so to speak. I'm not sure if that really is what you wanted to hear. It's not, because there isn't any kind of obvious and immediate answers to these things. Okay, I'll do one more question, and then I'll probably see what happens with this question, and then maybe call it a day after that. Actually, see what happens here. Recently, I've been beginning to feel good during and after meditation. Okay, good. Doing the right thing here. However, I feel I am still thinking during meditation. Is this possible? Sure, it's possible. It is, if you're feeling good, you're going the right way. Thinking may be there for a long time. What is probably happening is that your thinking is either slowing down, there's less thinking. What you're thinking, and what you will maybe see, is that the thinking that you have now is more clear than the thinking you had before. That already is a movement in the right direction. That clarity of thinking means your mind is becoming more pure. Your mind is becoming more still. You have more mindfulness already. That's a good sign. Another good sign is look at the content of the thinking. What are you actually thinking here? It may be that the thoughts you're having are more good thoughts, more pure thoughts. Thoughts connected with the Dhamma or whatever it is. There is a beautiful sutta. This is in the Majjhima Nikaya 18, called the Two Kinds of Thought, or 19 actually it is. And the Buddha said that before his enlightenment, he divided his thinking mind into two categories. Thoughts that had to do with loving kindness, compassion, and renunciation on the one hand, and thoughts that had to do with harm, ill will, and desire on the other hand. And he said that he was able to think about these good thoughts all the time. And then he says, I can see no danger coming from that kind of thought. So if your thoughts are going the right way, you're thinking good thoughts, you are going in the right direction. But the next thing he said is that if I keep thinking, even if I keep thinking good thoughts all the time, and I can't see any danger from that, still it will take my mind away from samadhi, away from meditation, because it will make me tired. And when I become tired, I become restless and all these kind of things. So still, I want to move towards meditation. But at the very least, you're going in the right place. So it's perfectly possible to enjoy your meditation and still have a little bit of thinking going on. There's no contradiction there. But you want to go deeper. So keep going. You're going the right way. Keep going. Become even more peaceful, even more relaxed, even better. And then you will find that there's much, much more to meditation than just having nice thoughts or peaceful thoughts. You can go much, much deeper than that. That's perfectly good. Okay, there's only two questions left, so I'll finish them off. Can meditation, if done frequently enough, cure physical ailments? There is a lot of anecdotal evidence that meditation can sort of indirectly cure physical ailments. I think what is happening here, and it's important to understand the mechanism behind this, you find that even scientifically, it has been shown that people who have a positive attitude when they have an operation, for example, and compared to people who have a negative attitude, the ones with positive attitude always have less complication, they heal faster, everything is much more easy for them after an operation. Of course, from a Buddhist point of view, this makes sense. It's just this is just the way things are. A positive attitude always leads to better results. And now it is also accepted by, as far as I know, it's fully accepted in scientific circles as well. So yes, it can help to cure it. And the reason why meditation helps cure it is precisely because it leads to a good attitude. You are more relaxed, you are more friendly, you have a sense of metta and compassion towards yourself and everybody else. And very often, if you have a cancer, often people might get angry with the cancer. We say, as Buddhists, we say, actually, much better to have metta towards your cancer. The cancer is there. Whether you are kind to it, or whether you're angry to it, it's not going to go away immediately anyway. The cancer is there. It's just these cells growing in there. It's just not going to help you to be angry. In fact, it's counterproductive. So have a metta towards the cancer. Whatever cancer happens, may you be well and happy. It's okay. You can be there if you want to. And of course, if you really have that attitude, and this is not like a business deal, as Ajahn Brahm would say, whereby you know, if I say you can stay, then you have to disappear. If you have that business deal, it's not going to work. You have to mean it. You actually can stay there if you really want to. And if that means death, so be it. But, of course, what really happens when you do that is that the cancer tends to, usually, not always, because it depends on all kind of other causes as well, but sometimes it will then disappear because of that. Final question for the afternoon. I have a condition called constant ringing in the ears, and I'm finding it difficult to meditate in silence. Do you have any advice on how best to overcome this? Good question. Try maybe doing some metta meditation instead, where you use your mind, you focus on the well-being of yourself and other people. See if that works. If you find that the hearing, the sound in the ear is becoming a distraction, and your mind goes there all the time, then it's what I was saying before, basically, that the mind tends to go to unpleasant things in the world, tends to go to external things that are unpleasant. So you need basically something else to focus on. So keep on do some kind of meditation that is coarse enough that you're able to keep your meditation on it. If you just try to be silent and you have ringing in your ear, it is quite likely that your mind will go to the ringing because the meditation is not coarse enough, if you like, gross enough, or it's too refined for you to be able to keep your focus on the meditation object. So do a bit of metta. Do a bit of something with a little bit of activity, not a lot of activity, but a little bit. So you can visualize a person, visualize the eastern direction, may all beings there be happy and well, and see if that gets you away from some of the ringing sensation. You've got to try different things, but really it's about doing something which is gross enough, coarse enough, that it actually keeps your attention on it. That's really what it's about, I think. No kind of absolute answer on that one. So, any further questions? Anybody has there? Yes. Well, the evidence for rebirth is that there is particularly one researcher in the U.S., a man called Ian Stevenson, who did a lot of research on children who remembered past lives. And he looked at the memories of past lives, and then he went to the places that they actually remembered, and he looked at whether those memories actually matched up with the place that actually existed. And to his great surprise, often there was a very close coincidence between the memories of the child and the things that they remembered. Actually, these people actually existed. The places existed. And I think it was very fascinating because there was an American philosopher, which I saw, he had a very short clip on YouTube later on, and he said that he had by accident come across this book by Dr. Ian Stevenson, and he had read it, and he said that, well, if this is for real, and there's no reason to think it's not for real, then any person who is rational has to, you know, seriously consider the existence of rebirth, because there is no other good explanation for this data. That was a philosopher, he's supposed to be the most rational of people. So that was a very kind of strong statement. But you have to remember that one of the problems is, and this is where sometimes you have to be very careful, one of the problems with the world and is that there is now a general scientific kind of negativity towards the idea of rebirth. I think because it is considered like religious or whatever, so science doesn't really like the idea of rebirth. But you have to be careful not to sort of, you have to see the distinction between what science likes and what science actually has shown to be definitely true. And when it comes to the science of the mind, basically science is still very, very, you know, uncertain of what the mind is all about and what's happening with the mind. So, yeah. Okay, so please enjoy your retreat. Don't forget to enjoy. That's the most important thing. Yeah. If you enjoy yourself, you are going to go far in meditation practice. Okay, so let's pay our respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.